So last time, as I said, I introduced the book, and just to recap that very briefly, I talked about how the author is probably an educated Jew who, not probably, it's an educated Jew who knows Greek very well. His style is very high register. He's educated in the Greek Old Testament. He's educated in Greek rhetoric and Greek philosophy. And this is apparent in the first four verses of the entire book that we'll look at tonight. It's very clear that this is a different kind of writer than you find anywhere else in the New Testament. The style that we see in these first four verses and elsewhere, of course, are just so much of stylistic import and excellence than anywhere else. And I don't want anybody to be bothered by that, right? I mean, even though all the New Testament writers are inspired by the same God, does that mean they all have to write the same, in the same style? No. So I don't want anybody to be bothered by that. If we say somebody's style is better than the others, it's just God allowed them to use their own strength, their own educational background. So I don't think we should be terribly surprised by that. So we talked about the authorship issue. We talked about the range of dates, which is 60 to 100. I don't think we can be any more precise than that. We just don't have enough information. We talked about the genre of this work, that even though it's sometimes referred to as an epistle, strictly speaking, it's a word of exhortation. It's more like a sermon. Even though the ending does kind of resemble an epistle, the beginning certainly doesn't, as we'll see in just a minute. We also talked about two major themes that you see in the book: listening to God's voice and the superiority of Jesus. And you see both of those in the first four verses. So, let's begin then. So, first four verses. In Greek, this is one sentence. And we don't have time and just take too long to really explain what he's doing here. But this is extremely elegant in Greek. I think it comes out in the translation too. So, he says, long ago God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by or through the prophets. But in these last days he has spoken to us by a Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being, and he sustains all things by his powerful word. When he had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. Okay, we could spend the entire time on these four verses. That is not my intention, but if we do, it's obviously not the end of the world either, right? It would be a great use of our time for sure. But I do intend to go beyond these four verses in chapter one. But let's now look at some of this in detail, because some of the things he says here, pretty clear, others aren't. And so I think it's worth investigating, well, what is he talking about exactly? So we see in the first two verses, there is a contrast between two periods of time: the former age and the last days. The former age is characterized by God speaking through the prophets, and notice it says many and various ways. This translation makes them sound almost like synonyms. They're two adverbs. They're not really synonyms. It's used to refer to the fact that God spoke to the prophets in diverse ways. Well, he spoke to them through oracles, most commonly, but he also used other kinds of teaching, other kinds of revelation. I think that's partly what he's saying, but also, there's a diversity of the amount of revelation that occurs in the Old Testament. In other words, it doesn't just happen all at once, nor does it happen continuously. There are periods of time in the Old Testament where revelation is very scarce. Can anybody think of a time where that's the case? The text specifically says that. Can anybody think of that? Okay, 1 Samuel 4 is a place where you find that God did not speak to his people at that point very often. It had been a long time. So that's just one example, but there are other examples too. Okay, so that's, I think those two aspects is what he's mentioning here. So that's how God spoke to the prophets. But in the last days, and this terminology simply here is used to talk about the messianic age and everything that's encompassed in that. This includes the church. This includes Jesus' incarnation, but it also includes his return, the final judgment, etc. All that is encompassed in this. And that may seem strange because now we're looking at it and we're saying, well, this time period is 2,000 years? Yeah, it is. Okay, no problem, right? There's really no, I don't think there's any difficulty to that. So what's the distinction? In the previous time he spoke by the prophets, now it's by the Son. Notice already the distinction. He doesn't say he's spoken by the Son in many ways and at various times or anything like that. No, there's a finality here. There's a singleness here. The final word has been spoken through his Son. That's it. There's no more revelation, just by his Son. Now, of course, by extension, we can think about his apostles, his disciples. But that's it. Okay, there isn't any more. Now, he refers to him as an heir of all things. This probably is an allusion to Psalm 2 that he's going to quote a little bit later, but it also could have other implications. We don't necessarily have to go into that. But then it says, through whom he also created the world. Some translations have through whom he also created the worlds, plural. And in the Greek, it's plural. So what does he mean here? Well, sometimes the plural can stand for the singular, but some translations even have he created the ages. Now, that wouldn't be terribly incohesive with regard to the context, right? He's talking about different ages. So that would make sense. But there's also a spatial sense that's associated with this word too. But I point this out because the translation that he created the worlds might make it seem like this is a reference to like other planets or something. And I say that now because that's such a hot topic in our society, is to hear about all these other planets that exist. One number is like 40 billion, I think, or something like that. Planets that are like ours, it's like ridiculous. Or not like ours, but just planets in general. But there are a bunch of planets that are supposedly like ours. In other words, he's not talking about that. That's just not what he has in mind. Okay. Any questions so far? All right. Yep. I think it was the same time, so you can flip a coin or something.
What's the significance of, let me ask
it,
is it restrictive? They said God spoke to our ancestors.
Oh, okay. Restrictive in what sense? What was the first part of that? Is it restrictive in what sense, I guess is my question. I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, that's a good question. Who's he talking about? And normally when we see answers, we automatically think the patriarchs. But I think it's beyond that. It's the people of Israel, generally. Yeah, what were you going to say?
So, it's a similar question, but I'll handle it. Your version up there says by a son.
Yeah.
The New American Standard says in his son.
Okay. Right.
Speaking to us earlier, is there any significance to that being done? Is it more of a reference that he is an exact representation? It's not that he's speaking to us through his son, but his son is the spoken one.
Well,
is that reading way too much?
I wouldn't say that here necessarily. I mean, that connection is made in the first chapter of John, of course, but here I don't necessarily think he's saying that. And literally, it is in a son. That's literally what it says. But the thing is, with prepositions, you can translate them in different ways. In is the typical meaning for this word, but it can mean other things too. Okay, so he's heir of all things through whom he also created the world. Now, there's a passage of, in a Jewish text that's not in the Old Testament. It's part of the Jewish pseudepigrapha, but it has a very similar beginning, and it was written probably about the same time as Hebrews was, and it's this book called Second Baruch, and it's preserved in Syriac, the Syriac language. There probably was an original Greek copy. But this is what it says. You can see the connections. In former times, in generations of old, our fathers had helpers, righteous men and holy prophets. I mean, think about that. That's almost identical to what we have in Hebrews 1:1. But then look at what he says. But now the righteous have been gathered and the prophets have fallen asleep. We also have gone forth from the land, and Zion has been taken from us, and we have nothing now except the Mighty One and His Torah, or His law. See the difference? This is actually, when you compare it to Hebrews 1, it's a very good text to compare the different ways of thinking about current situation between Christians and Jews. Christians say, okay, He spoke in previous generations by the prophets, now through His Son. Here, it says He spoke in previous generations by the prophets, and they don't speak anymore. We don't have that anymore. We do have His Torah, which does contain those oracles, but no one now is speaking. In Hebrews, it says God has spoken through His Son. Again, as I said, the final word. So I think that kind of sheds light maybe on the significance of what the Hebrew writer is saying. Okay, now, we get to verse 3. He's the reflection of God's glory. What's God's glory? We sing about it, we talk about it, we read about it, but what does it really mean? Nobody knows? Wow, I'm just kidding. It's one of those things that we talk a lot about. We think a lot, maybe not think about it, but we talk a lot about it. But when it comes down to actually defining it, it's difficult. Does anybody want to take a stab at it? Man, you guys are sheepish. What? I think it's part of it, for sure. Yeah. Brave soul.
Maybe God's glory is the fact that we can't understand it. Because if you take it on, you have to thank God that created everything around us. Why do we want, or why do we expect that our brains that are about the size of our fist to be able to comprehend and understand everything and just full power, if that makes sense. Okay. So his glory, we can't understand it because it's above us.
Well, I mean, I think that's true. And the fact that you said we can't understand everything is certainly, I think, accurate. To say that we can't understand anything, which is what some people have said, well, why are we even bothering if that's the case, right? I think we can understand some, but like you said, not everything. Maybe glory is that way, but there is, I mean, there's something attached to that word. Yeah, did you have your hand up a while ago? Okay. Okay. Okay, good. Exactly. I think that's right. I think you might be next. John. Okay, that's, again, that is true, but it doesn't say God's nature. It says glory. And I do think there's a distinction. What you say is true. Don't misunderstand. But it does say glory. So we have to do something with that word. Why did the Hebrew writer use this word? Because it's got to be describable to some degree. Yeah.
Maybe the purity and sinlessness of God, but how He is the only
of what? Being that way? Yeah, okay. Again, partly, yeah.
I think what we're all grappling with is something we will be grappling with forever, and that is, what makes God so good? What makes God so much better than we are? What makes God so much higher than we are? And all we're told is He is, but we don't know how.
Right.
We don't know what.
Yeah. Right. So, trying to take all that together, I think what he said with reference to the Moses episode, where his face shone, glory, the Old Testament word, means something that's heavy. Okay, well, does that help? I mean, does this mean God is like a really heavy weight? No, of course that doesn't help. That's not really, that's the base meaning of the word. But it has something to do with his brightness, at least according to Moses, and his brightness may reflect the distinctiveness that God has toward us. So, and the reason I want to sort of stick with the idea of brightness is because it says reflection, okay? Which, so there's something to that. Maybe God's glory that represents some attribute of God is revealed to human beings as this just nearly indescribable brightness. And so Jesus is a reflection of that. Yeah.
I think you can also reference that to the Transfiguration.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a piece to that.
Yeah.
It's interesting in Exodus there where it's found, it said his face shone because of his speaking with him. I don't know if that's the words or the presence or both.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was that action that took place that was transferred somehow to Moses, and I think we see that transfiguration occurring
yep.
in the New Testament.
Yep. I think the transfiguration is a really good thing to bring up. Okay, so I don't know if anything I said makes it any clearer, but it's certainly worth thinking about. Yeah. Radiance. Yeah, exactly. That's another perfectly adequate way to translate that. In fact, I think I like that better than reflection. Yeah, radiance does bring out. Some translations, or at least one I looked at, has effulgence or something, which is a word we typically don't use. So yeah, I think radiance will work. So then he says, all right, he's the radiance of God's glory. He's the radiance of God's brightness, which signifies his distinctiveness, maybe, and in the exact imprint of God's very being. This is another word. This is the word from which we get character. We use it to talk about, that guy's a character or something, but that's not what I mean. It's like, you're talking about Chinese or something, the language. You say, well, that's a Chinese character, right? It's a symbol. Well, that's what we have here, the word that's translated the exact imprint. It can be used to talk about, like on coins, the imprinting process on a coin. So, but here, God's very being is an important word later on in the 4th century debates about the nature of Jesus with reference to God. That's, way down the road. That's not what he's talking about here. And then it says he sustains all things by his powerful word. This is kind of funny because, or there's one thing that's funny about this. This translation, he sustains, this word that's translated that. There's one textual witness that has, he reveals all things by his powerful word. And there's another scribe that comes back and says, don't change the original. You evil, wicked person. So I think what that means is sustains is probably the correct reading. Although, reveals all things by his powerful word makes complete sense in the context. So then it says, he made purification for sins. He sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. So this introduces an idea, a quotation from Psalm 110 that we'll look at in a minute. But now, here's another idea that is present. And so, all right, Here's what we're trying to do, as far as I'm concerned. We're trying to recreate what the original hearers of the work would think when they first heard it. That's what I'm trying to do. And notice I said hearers, because we can imagine the situation being that there, whoever the community was that received this, maybe there weren't many of them that could read. So somebody would be standing up here like I am, reading the text. You all would be hearing it, like for the first time. So what would pop in their minds when they heard it? That's what I'm trying to recreate. So as we do this, that's why we look at these other texts that aren't in our Bibles. And that's, so here we have the wisdom of Ben Sira, which is a very influential work. It's in the Septuagint. If you have a Catholic Bible, or you go buy a Catholic Bible, this is going to be in there. It's one of the deuterocanonical books in the Catholic Bible. It's also part of the Protestant, in the Protestant tradition, it's part of the Apocrypha. But this is talking about wisdom, wisdom personified, like in Proverbs 8. So there's scriptural precedent for this. And if you remember, in Proverbs 8, it talks about wisdom, Lady Wisdom, being present at creation. And that's what it's talking about here in Wisdom 7. For she, wisdom, is a reflection. You know what word that is? Same word we have in Hebrews 1. Reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God, and an image of His goodness. The word I have underlined here, image, not the same word you have in Hebrews 1, but it's very close conceptually. All right. So what the Hebrew writer is doing, I think, is he's taking these traditions about wisdom and saying Jesus is that. Jesus is wisdom, which I think is a really interesting idea. I think, you know, again, we try to recreate what ancient readers would have heard. They hear what the Hebrew writer says, and they remember this passage, and they say, wait a minute. Is he saying that it's wisdom is actually to be identified with Jesus? And I think that's exactly what he's doing. I hope that makes sense. I know that may be something you may not have thought about before, but I really do think this is what's happening. All right. So the next thing that I mentioned was this passage in Psalm 110. Some have argued that Psalm 110 is the passage behind the entire sermon of Hebrews. I don't know if I'd go that far, but it occurs over and over in Hebrews. And he's already alluding to the fact that he's going there, right? So in Psalm 110, Yahweh says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. So he says that the Son sat down at the right hand of God. Where do they get that terminology? Psalm 110. And Psalm 110 is quoted over and over again, not just in Hebrews, but also elsewhere in the New Testament. The other passage from this psalm that gets discussed a lot, as some of you certainly know, is verse 4, Yahweh has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So in Psalm 110, the Hebrew writer finds, you might say, his material in which he wants to orient Jesus, orients the discussion about Jesus. Okay, Psalm 110. So we'll have much more to say about that passage as we go along. All right, now we get to verse 5 of chapter 1. Anything else about the first four verses? Like I said, we could spend a lot more time with that, but we won't. Yeah.
Just the thought, just because, I mean, they recognize the words of the prophets. They just held those in such high esteem, correct?
Yep.
And I mean, to me, it sounds like he's saying, you know, I would speak through the prophets, but Jesus, and the message was through the prophets, but Jesus, Christ, is the message. He's not bringing the message, but he is the message.
And I think that's kind of what he was saying. Yeah, and I think what you say does remind me of something that maybe I could go ahead and say now. It's certainly something I want to mention later, will mention later, because I'm sure I'll forget what I'm saying right now. But when he brings in all these points of comparison, We aren't to think, oh, he's belittling them a little bit. The prophets were imperfect. Moses, you know, made mistakes. The Levitical priesthood's kind of, eh. No. We are to think about these things as, oh, the prophets, Moses, the Levitical priesthood. But as great as they are, Jesus is even more superior. You see, that's a stronger argument. And I also think that's exactly what he's doing. I mean, yes, by comparison, all those things are going to be less. But I don't think it's a case where he's saying, Jesus is just so much superior because they were so bad. No, it's the other way around. Jesus is so great because they were great too. He's even better. So, yeah, I'm glad you said that because that reminded me. All right, now we get to verse 5, and this is where he properly begins the argument for the rest of chapter 1. But he's introduced a bunch of stuff he's going to say again in the first four verses. But he says, to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my son, today I've begotten you, or again, I will be his father, and he will be my son. And again, when he brings the firstborn of the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. Of the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds, his servants flames of fire. But of the son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of your kingdom. He quotes from several different passages here. Psalm 2, Psalm 110, Psalm 45, etc. And what's the point he's trying to make? So we, you know, it's easy to get lost in all these quotations and, you know, what was the original context? And we're not going to do that with every single case. Sometimes we will, because I think it's interesting to look at that and see exactly what the Hebrew writer is trying to do here. But what is he doing overall? He's showing Jesus' superiority to the angels. He's already mentioned Jesus' superiority to the prophets. Now he's doing it with regard to the angels. But here's the question. Why angels? See, here in a little bit, he's going to talk about Jesus' superiority to Moses. Why would he choose that? It's obvious. Moses was a lawgiver. Moses was a highly esteemed figure in Jewish tradition in the Old Testament. It makes perfect sense. Why would he compare Jesus to the Levitical priesthood? Levitical priesthood had a tremendously important role in the Old Testament and in Jewish tradition. But the angels? Why does he start with that? Well, the answer is at least in part found in chapter 2, verse 2. So he says that we must pay greater attention to what we've heard so that we do not drift away from it. For if the message declared through angels was valid and every transgression or disobedience reserved a just penalty, how can we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? What is he talking about? The message delivered by angels. Anybody know? Well, and I think that's true, and I think it's even more explicit in a couple of places we'll see in just a minute. Yeah.
Also, would it be talking about the angels that Zechariah and Joseph and Mary that thing?
No. I think he is talking about the Old Testament law.
Okay.
And now, here's the problem, though. If you go to Exodus 20, which is the account of the giving of the Ten Commandments. Who's giving the commandments to Israel? This is a little bit trick question maybe, but who's giving the commandments, the Ten Commandments to Israel in Exodus 20? It's God Himself, remember? And then the people say, we can't handle this anymore. And then that's when He brings Moses in. Is there any mention of angels in Exodus 20? Not Exodus 20. However, there is a passage in Deuteronomy 33, verse 2, that does mention the myriad of His holy ones when it talks about Him coming from Sinai. Now, this is going to take a little bit of explaining. Remember what I said at the very beginning of class today and in the last class. The Hebrew writer is an educated Jew familiar with the Greek Old Testament. Is the Greek Old Testament and the Hebrew Old Testament exactly the same in every respect? They're not. That's just reality. They're not. Does the Hebrew writer know the Hebrew language? I don't know. No indication. But he knows the Greek Old Testament. The Greek Old Testament of Deuteronomy 33:2 reads this way: "The Lord came from Sinai, dawned over them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran with a myriad of his holy ones. From his right hand, angels were with him." Angels were with him. In the Old Testament, in Hebrew, it just says something like his right hand was burning or something. Anybody look it up? What does your translation have for 33:2 at the end? What?
Flashing lightning.
There's something going on with the text here. I don't know what it is. But the Greek Old Testament has angels. Now, if that's all we had, okay, you might think, well, that's not particularly strong. But look where else we have this. Acts 7. This is the speech of Stephen, right? He said, "You are the ones that received the law as ordained by angels, and yet you have not kept it." Galatians 3:19. "Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions until the offspring would come to whom the promise had been made, and it was ordained through angels by a mediator." Who's the mediator there of the law? Moses. So you see, in this verse, Paul mentions the angels and Moses. How is this not what the Hebrew writer is talking about? I mean, I'm convinced it's absolutely what he's talking about. Any questions about this? And again, I don't think this is something that should bother us just because it doesn't occur in Exodus 20. We have plenty of cases in Scripture that talk about the same event where some details are in one place and not another, right? So that's what we have here. That's all we have here. That's the way I would look at it. Any questions or comments about this? Okay, so why does he begin with angels? Because they are associated with the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. That's why he does it. Now, some have said, well, he's also combating the worship of angels. There's just, well, no evidence of any Jews worshiping angels in the first century. And somebody might say, well, what about that passage in Colossians, right? I don't even think that's what's going on there either. So that's problematic. So if you remove that possible reference, that's all it is possible. There's nothing else. There's nothing. There's no evidence of that. Is it possible? Yeah, I mean, it's possible something was going on that we don't know about. But from the evidence we have, we can't say that. And some have said, well, it's not really the worshiping of angels, but it is worship involving angels, which is a concept you find in places like the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. I still am not convinced about that. I think the text is pretty clear. We have it in Hebrews 2, verse 2, and it just so happens he introduces the whole idea of angels and Jesus' superiority angels before that. Any questions or comments about that? Anybody think I'm wrong? Nah, we don't want to hear from you. Okay, so, No, I may be. It's like I told my class the other day, I'm probably wrong in something I'm teaching. I just don't know what it is. So that's a bit of a problem. All right, so, verse 5 again. Which of the angels did he ever say? So he's showing Jesus' superiority over the angels in the same way he's going to do it with regard to Moses. And the difference is, as great as Moses was, as great as the angels are, they're not sons. They are not God, and they are not God's son. That's what he's saying here. All right. So Psalm 45 is the passage he quotes here in verse 8. So he quotes Psalm 2, 2 Samuel 7, and then verse 8, the Son says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of your kingdom. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I do want to go back to verse 7 very quickly. There, do you see what he's saying? He's saying the angels basically are God's servants. He tells them what to do. You have this fear of activity, you have this fear of activity. That doesn't describe the relationship Jesus has with the Father. He's a son. Okay, so I did want to say that very quickly. Now, verse 8, Psalm 45. Psalm 45, the background of that psalm seems to be the marriage of the king. That seems to be the setting for this particular psalm. So, it says, in your majesty, I don't know what majesty is, but majesty, ride on victoriously for the cause of truth and to defend the right. Let your right hand teach you dread deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies, and the peoples fall under you. Who is being addressed here? That's important. Psalm 45. Who's being addressed? In your majesty, ride on victoriously. Bit of a trick question. We see that word majesty. Sounds like God, right? But then it says, your arrows are sharp in the heart of your king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. Your throne, O God, endures forever and ever. Your royal scepter is a scepter of equity or righteousness. That sounds like God. But then look at verse 7. You love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. Now, hold on a minute. How can God anoint himself? What's happening in this psalm is very, I think, interesting, because it's addressing the king as if it were God, which is highly unusual in ancient Israelite society. When you look at other ancient Near Eastern kingdoms, like Egypt, for example, the kings were identified with the gods, but not in Israel. I mean, that is the one thing that Israel never does. There isn't any indication they ever do that. So I think what's happening in this psalm is he's playing with that idea, but he's saying it's as if God's going to be with the king to such a degree that it might as well be God out there on the battlefield. Now, of course, in Hebrews, it makes sense because God is the Son, but at the same time in verse 7, God has anointed you. Anointed, this word that's translated anointed, is where we get the word Messiah from. Okay, so all that I think fits together. So think about this, and this is the last, we're out of time. Doesn't it end at 7:40? Isn't that right? I should know that by now, right? But anyway, what was I forgot what I was going to say now. It's really important too. Oh yeah. I got it now. What can you imagine how shocking this might be to hear someone refer to somebody else as God that wasn't Yahweh? You see, for us, this we're so accustomed to thinking about Jesus as God that I think we forget the shock value it would have had for a first century Jew who was so entrenched in the idea of monotheism that they couldn't even entertain anything like this. And yet, the early Christians are so convinced that Jesus is God, they can say stuff like this. Now again, they're inspired. I understand that. But I also think the Hebrew writer would have said this whether he's inspired or not. So he refers to Jesus as God, and your throne will endure. Your power, your reign will endure forever and ever. You see, here's the whole point of what he's saying. The angels are servants. The Son has a throne that's going to rule forever and ever. He's not a servant in the sense that the angels are. He's the ruler. That's the point here. All right, we'll pick this up on Sunday.